Hello, you're very welcome to Think For Yourself, and specifically to part two of this six-part special series entitled Voices From Gaza. I'm your host, Ewan McKenna. Now, as I said last Friday, the aim of this is to hear different opinions and outlooks from both within and beyond the horror, from both sides of the divide and from both ends of the brutality, from the philosophical to the political, the economic to the medical, and on into the outright desperation on the ground. And on that note, in terms of life in Gaza, if you haven't listened to that opening show from just a few days back with Dr. Mohammed Al-Aqwad, who was trapped there for over a year and shared his experiences and terror across that time, and frankly, those same ongoing emotions in exile as he tries to keep tabs on family and friends, I do think it's worth your while to get a sense of all this, regardless of your persuasion or preconceived views on this, as the purpose of this series is to come into it with an open mind and listen to those involved to various degrees. Also, if you could give this a share online and a suggestion to a friend in the real world, that would help me to keep doing this. And also, I do think the more that can hear these stories, the better for us all. Now, on that note, let's get on to this episode two, where I was joined by the excellent and hugely insightful and deeply thoughtful Keith Cann Harris. He's a sociologist and music critic, an honorary research fellow and senior lecturer at Birkbeck College, an associate fellow of the Institute for Jewish Policy Research, and a lecturer at Leo Bake College. He's also published a wide-ranging set of academic and non-academic articles on Judaism, the music scene, heavy metal, transgression, Israel, communities, dialogue, religion, ethnicity, political discourse, and importantly, with regards to today, denial. This was our conversation. Keith, it's lovely to have you with me. If we can jump in. I know in your writing you distinguish between Zionism and, for want of a better word, non-Zionist Judaism, but there is some crossover. Can you talk to me in terms of outlook and practicality? What are the key elements of that differentiation?
Well, I mean, the first thing I have to point out is that Zionism is not monolithic anyway, and it never has been. It's true that the constituent streams within Zionism are not always immediately visible to the outside, but there are significant differences between the religious maximalist, if you like, Zionism that you see within the settlement movement and the liberal left-wing Zionism that has quite a powerful presence, not just here, but also in some parts of Israel as well, in the more secular parts of Israel. How you differentiate that from non-Zionism is complicated, because I do make the distinction between non-Zionism and anti-Zionism, although it's not an absolute distinction, whereas I would see that anti-Zionism is a sort of proactive attempt to push back against Zionism and have a different sort of vision for what the Jewish people should be doing and what should happen in Israel-Palestine. Non-Zionism can sometimes be an attempt to refuse sort of Zionist, anti-Zionist binaries. It can sometimes be a pragmatic sense of connection to Israel, but without necessarily buying into the more ideological aspects of Zionism. And it can sometimes be a deliberate attempt to muddy the waters to try and avoid some of the controversy and bitter division, both within the Jewish community and outside it.
How has that division, has it grown or within Judaism and in that community since October 7th? Where does that division lie now?
Well, I can speak most about the UK. That's what I know most about the Jewish community in the UK. First of all this plays out very differently in the diaspora and in Israel itself. The thing is, they don't always map onto each other. Very, very broadly speaking, surveys that have done by the Institute for Jewish Policy Research, where I work, although not on that particular issue, funnily enough, have shown that there has been a growth of the non-anti-Zionist positions, at least on Israel at the moment. But it's a relatively modest one. We're talking about maybe 10%, something like that, a growth from some to somewhere between 10 and 20%. But ideologically, most of the community is, in terms of its principles, pretty similar to what it was pre-October the 7th. It's the political center of gravity within British Jewry, which of course is very diverse, but is speaking very generally, the pendulum tends to swing towards what one might be called liberal Zionism, the kind of Zionism that may be suspicious of the settlement enterprise, that does not yearn for a greater Israel, that in principle is open to the idea of Palestinian statehood in some form within a two-state solution. And that's very roughly where the center of gravity is. But of course, attitudes to this the current war and what should be done and Netanyahu are not quite the same thing as fundamental principles. And whereas the fundamental principles have not changed massively, although, as I say, there's been a modest growth in non and anti-Zionist opinion. There is, if you like, a contradiction that is present in Israel as well in some quarters, where there is a general support for the war, at least up to a certain point, but with very negative feelings about Netanyahu. Netanyahu is not popular in the British Jewish community, although there are Jews who admire Netanyahu in Britain, but it's not where the political center of gravity is. So that kind of contradiction, which is often loathing Netanyahu, but in very broad terms, seeing no alternative to this current war that Netanyahu himself is leading, that kind of contradiction is very widespread. And to some extent in Israel as well. So it's not a simple situation.
It's slightly off topic, but because it is topical, I was curious, knowing you were coming on, what you made of Glastonbury in terms of A, what happened, and B, in terms of the reaction to it.
Well, I was worried you were going to ask me that. I find myself quite disturbed by it across the spectrum. I did think there was something about Israel being the exception to Glastonbury's generally mildly hippie-ish ethos, I thought was very striking, although politics at Glastonbury has never been quite as unknown as people might like to think. I thought that there were things that Bob, is it villains or violence?
I think it's villain, but I'm not hip.
Bob Villain. I thought the most disturbing thing he said was not the death to the IDF thing, but a bit that has not been quoted so much, where he was talking in fairly vicious terms about his ex-boss of his record label, where he was starting to veer into some Zionist means Jew type rhetoric, which I found quite disturbing. I did think, ironically, death to the IDF was quite striking in the sense that it shows a sort of a more direct targeting of quote unquote the enemy than you sometimes find. So it's not death to Israel or death to Israelis or death to Zionists, but death to the IDF specifically. I thought that was striking. What I didn't hold to, though, was I was sympathetic. There's a lot of horror in the Jewish community about this. And I take that horror seriously, even if I don't buy into its more extreme formulations. I mean, there have been people that I know who've been saying things like, I could not go to Glastonbury again, or I'm not paying the BBC TV license again, as though what happened on that one particular stage at one particular time sort of defines the whole. I think people made quite a, some people I know made sort of some very sweeping statements about what the people, what the audience actually believed, like it was a pro-Hezbollah audience, a pro-Hamas audience, that I think was far too sweeping. And I think generally, there is often an inability to recognize that the pro-Palestinian movement contains different streams within it, some of which are indeed supportive of people like Hezbollah and Hamas, others which are just there because they don't like the suffering they're seeing, and it doesn't go much beyond that. But at the end of the day, one thing I would say is that this was a process of moral panic. But the process of moral panic today doesn't necessarily work as it might have done a few decades ago. Moral panic is a brilliant thing for the artists who are targeted about it. This has been brilliant for Kneecap. This has been brilliant for Bob, whatever his name is. And it's been brilliant also for right-wing culture warriors as well. You know, like in moral panic, both the accused and accuser do well out of it. But the people who don't do well out of it are people who are not in it for the moral panic, but are in it because they really feel something. And so I have to think about writing something, and then I think, you know, this is so contentious that I had other things to do this week that took priority. So there's where I am on it.
Can I take you back, Keith, to October 7th, 2023, and your day as those events unfolded and your emotions as they unfolded?
So I think the first thing to say that's sometimes forgotten about October 7th is it was on the day of a Jewish festival. And so a lot of Jews who Orthodox practicing Jews would be in shul and would not use devices for that entire that day and the day after. So I'm not an Orthodox practicing Jew, and although I feel bad about it, I do check social media. But it was a kind of day off for me. I wasn't in synagogue, but I was at home. And it was quite weird at first because the first thing I saw was some kind of broadcast by a Gazan journalist from a village just inside Israel. And I really didn't know what that actually was. And I think the first few reports of it seemed to suggest kind of mass trespass, if you like, making, you know, a sort of symbolic return home. And a lot of pro-Palestinian people I know were very excited about that and sort of jumped in. And then gradually over the hours, it became clear that something very, very bad was happening. Although the reports were fairly confusing, it took quite a while to actually sort out what was actually going on. And I remember seeing later in that day a film of a fairly elderly Israeli on the back of a moped in Gaza, surrounded by shouting people. And that's when I started to know what started to grasp the sort of the magnitude of what was going on. And I remember feeling horrified. For me personally, kidnapping is very triggering. I know it's not, you know, there are other terrible things that can happen in the world, but personally, When I saw that children were being taken, that made it even worse than that there were films of that. The other thing I remember is this trying to come to terms with the fact that the response to this was going to be unlike, from Israel, was going to be unlike anything we've seen before. And whilst I probably didn't predict quite how far things would go, certainly not that this would still be unfolding, getting on for 2 years afterwards, I knew this was going to be bad, very bad. And it already was bad, of course. There was also one thing I should also say is I do have relatives in Israel, but I'm not close to them, but my wife does. And so there was a, and they don't live in that region near Gaza, but nonetheless, there was that checking in with other people as well on Facebook who I knew were in Israel. And you see, Zionist or not, you can't cut Israel out of the Jewish people simply because we family and friendship connections are too, there's this whole web of connections. So regardless of what you felt about October the 7th or what you feel about Palestine or Gaza, on a human level, there was a lot of checking in going on, which was one of the defining aspects of that day and the days that followed.
You mentioned a kind of a worry about what would follow. As a Jew, and I know they're not your politicians per se, but as the leaders of Israel, when you heard in just a couple of quotes like Benjamin Netanyahu said, every person in Gaza is a terrorist. Yoav Gallant said, we're enacting a complete siege. There'll be no electricity, no food. Moshe Feilen said, Gaza needs to be turned into Dresden. Tali Gotlib said, there needs to be a doomsday weapon. Galat Atbrayan said these are monsters and will die, and on it goes. What did you feel when these are the leaders of Israel coming out with these words?
Well, I mean, one of the things I felt and still feel quite bitterly is that all of this was great news for Hamas. That this is exactly this kind of propaganda of the deed or whatever you'd call it, intends to create a horrific reaction that will rip the mask off the enemy and show its true vicious nature and will prevent any equivocation and make people choose sides. I've always felt that certainly the government as it is now and the Israeli right more generally is essentially allied with the with the sort of Hamas type politics and certainly has very similar goals in the sort of what it would like to see in the long term. And that may seem very dark, but it feels very dark. What's happened in Gaza has been a catastrophe for Palestinians, but it's been very good for Hamas. It's been very good. And it's been very good for Netanyahu. And that sense of disgust at hasn't left me. The sense that this is the most appalling kind of cynicism, and that this is no way to fight a war, and that this is no way to do anything. And I'm fully aware, of course, that this is asymmetric conflict. And it's very difficult to both take that those disparities into account, but at the same time to recognize that Hamas has had agency here and it continues to have agency here. That's generally where I've been, and it's been very dark because a position like that doesn't give you much to hold on to. One of the things that I've noticed about this conflict is how easy it is for some people. It's like sinking into a hot bubble bath. It was, I remember the days following October the 7th, there was a brief period where there was a little bit of an introspection by some pro-Palestinian voices out in Britain. But once the bombs started to fall, it was like, we can relax into a very easy situation where there's an easy enemy and we don't have to think too much. And there's a certain amount of that on the pro-Israel side as well. And that's the sort of thing that makes me despair, that for some people this is really easy.
You've written extensively about the diversity of Jewish identity. How has your own identity and, I guess, sense of Jewishness been affected by the last year and a half?
Well, for one thing, one thing that I'm very keen not to do is to I want to maintain my lines of communication across different Jewish factions. That's very important to me, a sense of Jewish peoplehood. And so I seek to understand and be empathetic towards Jews right across the spectrum and to give them a hearing. And when I speak, which I'm very careful when I do, I'm often talking about what other Jews like me are saying. And I don't want to play a game whereby I become, if people agree with me, then I'm the good Jew, right? I don't want to make it that easy. But obviously, it's had an impact on me personally. But I would say, one of the things I would say is for quite a long time, I've had a very idiosyncratic view about what Jews should be. I don't think our existence in the world should be dependent on us being good or bad, for that matter. I think peoplehood is something that just is. I don't think there's a moral right to exist as a people. Regardless, not just for Jews, but for anyone else, Palestinians included, Germans included. So it's not, I've never defined Judaism in terms of a particular moral perspective or a particular political perspective. So in that respect, nothing that's happened has disappointed me because I don't define Jewishness in that term. So my Judaism remains where it was. But what I have felt very, very strongly is that our sheer prominence at the moment is getting rather scary. Just the fact that that Israel Palestine has become so central to so many debates in so many areas makes us inevitably central to so many debates in so many areas. And the book I wrote that was conceived after October the 7th, called Everyday Jews, it came out in March, was basically a cry from the heart to say our sheer importance is not good for us, and we need to recover a sense of mundane, everyday Jewishness. And this sense of importance goes across lines. It's, you could be a Zionist or an anti-Zionist, whatever you are, we're there. And it's that, and we're often the focus for wider controversies. So I don't think it's good for the Jews, for the future of the BBC to be discussed via an issue to which we're central. So Glastonbury or the Eurovision Song Contest. And I think we're losing a sense of our normality through this. And that's a critique of pretty much every kind of Jewishness, but I also understand why it happens. So I'm sympathetic to, and I sometimes get caught up in it as well. I'm no saint in that regard. More specifically, the thing that I have been frustrated with about my fellow Jews is most of the world that I work in is a sort of liberal left leaning sort of Zionism. And I find this the contradiction of loathing the Israeli right, loathing Netanyahu, while still supporting wars that he leads. I find that a little bit very frustrating. I don't think you can separate from the war and the person running it. And I do feel that one of the saddest things is, although that's not what they necessarily want, that the relentless development of an Israel that's on the far right. Liberal Jews are implicated, even though it goes against their values, and even though they don't want that to happen, even though that's the absolutely last thing they want. And I really hope that, and there is debate about that. I'm not saying the only one who's pointed it out, but I think that is something that I find really sad. I find really sad because they're going to get an Israel that they don't want. And they already, in some ways, have an Israel they don't want. Another complicated answer. I'm answering very long.
No, no, it's really interesting. I was curious, just when you see, and this there's two parts to this, I guess. When you turn on the news and you see images out of Gaza, be it starving children, be it people being burnt alive, all these things that we have seen, A, what do you feel? And B, how do you feel about elements of Judaism who support and sometimes even cheer this on?
I tend to be quite strategic in my media diet. I don't actually watch TV news, although I'm obviously good. I read widely and I see videos all the time from social media. Particularly with things where kids, to do with kids, I find a lot of those images unbearable to look at. I think that you never know quite what you're going to get triggered by. It can sometimes be things that you didn't expect to be triggered by. I find the image of whole sections of the Gaza Strip reduced to rubble particularly difficult to watch. How that makes me feel about the Jews who support it. I think I feel the same way as I do about, or I try to ensure that the way I feel about it is the way I feel about it in other similar situations, like the Russian raising of Grozny or of Russian and Syrian great erasure of Aleppo. I try and see this as part of a wider tendency that is ascendant in the world today, and that this is Israel's version of that. I try not to see it as a crime with that is entirely exceptional, because it is not entirely exceptional. It doesn't make it any better, obviously. So I try and look at it through the lens of my wider political values. But what I don't refuse is the fact that by being Jewish, I'm connected to Jews like that. And it's probably inevitable that they're going to be Jews like that. And as I said before, I don't feel that the survival or the right to exist of Jews in the world is dependent on our good behavior. I never thought, I think that Jewishness is morally blank. Jewishness is whatever Jews want it to be. And some Jews will want it to be one thing and others will want it to be other things. So I don't think it's a betrayal of my Jewish values. I think it's a betrayal of my values. And I'm aware that that's a very idiosyncratic way of looking at things. The idea that Jewishness has no one center is, morally speaking, is not a common one. So I recognize that in saying this, I'm not really speaking for anybody other than myself.
I understand there's going to be a contradiction in this question, but it's kind of twofold. Firstly, being in Britain at the minute and across this, have you felt more uncomfortable being Jewish? And then secondly, and again to contradict myself almost, has the term anti-Semitic been overused and misused to the point where it's actually losing its meaning?
Well, in terms of how personally I'm feeling, I mean, I think you have to distinguish, first of all, between Jews who are quote unquote visibly Jewish and Jews like me that aren't. Although most Jews will recognize me as a Jew, most non-Jews will not. So I don't wear a skull cap, you know, for example. I do have a long beard, but it's not that kind of beard. It's Jews, it's Orthodox Jews who are at the front line. And it is Jews who are famous and public that are on the front line. It's true that I work for two Jewish organizations, but one of them, you would never even know where the, it's not a priority for any anti-Semite, and you would never even know that where our off. Our office is just a small office down an alleyway. So we're not really in danger. And the other one has very good security, but the security is not to the point where it's unbearable. So, you know, and it's always had security. Same goes for my synagogue, as well. So, in that respect, my everyday life is not defined by abuse and stuff like that. And in terms of online stuff, I've never been a very satisfying target because I don't come across as a defender of Israel or an accuser of Israel. I'm a bit too, I'm very careful in my position taking. So I don't really get a lot of abuse. I'm also not a woman. It's usually women who get it worse anyway. But in terms of the general environment, for me, it's very difficult because it's not it's part. I do think there's a rise in anti-Semitism, and I think it's real, and I think it's important. And as part of the Jewish community, I take seriously other Jews' perceptions of this, even when I don't share them. But for me, it's that sense that we are part of everything, that Israel-Palestine controversy is becoming part of so many different fields. I find that very uncomfortable. I find it uncomfortable across the board. I don't like us being so central to so much. I think there is constant pressure to pick a side. That is very intrusive and very crude. And whilst I do have a side and I do know what I oppose, that sort of sense that you have to speak out continuously, whether it's in favor of Israel or in favor of Palestine, can be very oppressive and can lead to a lot of groupthink and bullying. And that disturbs me enormously. So yeah, it's very uncomfortable. Now, has anti-Semitism been overused? What I would say here is that Jews have different levels of tolerance, of ability, of tolerance isn't the right word, of ability to deal with anti-Semitism and define it slightly differently and draw lines in different places. For the most part, it's whether you like it or not, it's sincere. I'm deeply embedded in the Jewish community, and it's not a community of cynics. I mean, they do exist. They exist more organizationally and in parts of the leadership rather than in grassroots Jews. I have to accept the reality of what people are feeling and to try and work with that, and as a sociologist, to try and understand that. I do think the term anti-Semitism is unhelpful for quite a lot of things. I think it funnels too many phenomena into one word. I don't, I think there are things that are bad for the Jews that are not necessarily anti-Semitic. But I also find that there is a blanket refusal in parts of the pro-Palestinian movement, in fact, in a lot of the pro-Palestinian movement, to engage in any way with the possibility of, at the very least, accidental anti-Semitic tropes and the idea of restricting anti-Semitism basically to neo-Nazis. I think there are ways in which certain kinds of criticism of Israel and anti-Zionism can be anti-Semitic. But I also recognize that at the moment, that kind of conversation isn't going to go anywhere because everything is so in the midst of a war, basically. It's very depressing. It's very depressing. I try and maintain an idiosyncratic position that allows me to speak and listen to a wide variety of perspectives. But it's not easy at the moment.
Does it worry you, Kate, that for a generation, maybe more than a generation, that the reputation of Israel has been damaged beyond repair? And I'm not saying it's right, but by extension, that is going to hurt the reputation of Jews, how they're seen by many Gentiles.
Yeah, it does worry me. Although I do think that sometimes criticism of Israel leverages pre-existing antipathy to Jews, but I recognize that that's not always the case. I think there are people, certainly many people in pro-Palestinian movements who would never gave a second thought to Jews before all of this happened. Mean, my awkward view on it is, and what I wrote about this in my 2019 book, Strange Hate, is that I don't think people have really understood what anti-racism really is. Anti-racism is protecting the rights of minorities to be loathsome, right? Anti-racism isn't about sympathy to people you like, right? It has to be possible for Jews in Britain to be able to live, not without criticism, but certainly without active hostility and abuse. It has to be possible for, as a more general point, for diasporas to be treated differently from states, even when they are often bound to states. I think that this is a problem that is only going to get worse and is not going to be confined to Jews in Israel. I think it's already starting that there are sections of the left whose relationship to Hindus is worsening because of the ascendancy of the Hindu rights in India. So I don't think we're unique to it, but we're certainly the biggest case of that. So I guess I'm sort of defending the right for Jews to have a bad reputation. We have to be able to live here, even if we make terrible political choices. There are nuances to that. There are caveats to that. I also think, though, that hostility to Israel out in Britain and elsewhere, and anti-Zionism, often has the paradoxical effect of making Jews grow closer to Israel and seeing it as an escape route. That's simply the reality. One of the reasons why liberal Zionists, why some liberal Zionists over here have supported the war while not supporting Netanyahu, is out of a sense that the survival of Israel is crucial. So without the survival of Israel, we are vulnerable in the world. And that may be true or not true, but it goes very deep. And it's quite counterproductive, to say the least, in Palestinian, pro-Palestinian activism. A lot of the time. And certainly when the idea of Jews being kicked out of Israel or being a persecuted minority under an Islamist regime, while many pro-Palestinians will scoff at that and say, no, that's not what we mean, it's not so impossible. And certainly some particularly Islamist opposition to Zionism does envisage something like that. So you might not share these fears, but those fears certainly prevent more Jews being able to reckon with what's been happening in their name in Gaza. And certainly many Jews are horrified by what's going on in Gaza, but don't feel they can oppose it, at least publicly, out of fear of what it will lead to.
Very last question then, Keith, and please don't take this as coming across like I'm holding you responsible. It's more, I've been asking people in Gaza this as well, from the other side. If you were face to face with some of those people I've spoken to who've lost family members, et cetera, within Gaza, as a Jew, what would you say to them?
That's a brilliant question and an almost impossible one. For me to apologize for my people might seem tempting. The problem is that I'm not accountable to for Jews who do things that are the complete antithesis of my values and for whom I didn't vote and for whom I never supported. I think that, speaking of me personally, a much more meaningful apology would be that I wasn't, when things were calmer, for example, in the 90s, that I didn't, and when the stakes were lesser for me, that I didn't work harder to raise awkward issues, because we're now at the point where the discourse is so clogged and so stuck that my own ability to change things are minimal to non-existent. I mean, they're pretty minimal even in the 90s, obviously. I think that I could have personally been braver, but that doesn't mean I'm accountable for what's happened to them. I think that if I were to meet Gazans in Gaza right now, my job would be to feel their sorrow and to take some of that burden, to take on some of that burden. But in terms of direct responsibility or complicity, if I do feel that, it's probably from something way back rather than something now.
Keith Can Harris there, and I'd like to thank him for his time and also the thoughtfulness of his insight, his answers, and introspection across that conversation. There are four more of these conversations to come within the next few days, and I do hope you're finding them worthwhile. In just a couple of more days, we'll be looking at life in the hospitals of Gaza, so I do hope you'll join me for that. In the meantime, if you could get the word out on social media and to those who may enjoy this, that would be hugely helpful and much appreciated. Until part three in this Voices from Gaza series, though, stay well.